You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the last 2 years, the Obama administration has approved more than $100 billion in weapon sales to nations in the Middle East alone. The deals have been some of the largest arms transfers ever and are part of a complex dance that's about maintaining U.S. leadership in the world and creating jobs at home. But arming countries around the world is not without risk. And joining us now is Mina Kimes, a staff writer for Fortune magazine. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, appears in the February 28th issue of the magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, these deals have been huge. The sale to Saudi Arabia alone was to the tune of $60 billion. Has the trend in overseas weapons sales been going up over the past few decades?
They've definitely been going up over the last 7 or 8 years. During the last Bush administration, we did see an increase in arms sales overseas. And this sort of represents a continuation and, I think, to many, a very surprising uptick, especially in 2010.
A surprising uptick because we thought the Obama administration would take a different tack?
I think some people expected this president to scale back, but if you look throughout history, that's actually not been the case with Democratic administrations. So in some ways, it shouldn't have been a surprise.
What kinds of weapons are being sold? Are we talking about big ticket items like jets and missiles or?
Well, we're talking about everything. But yeah, a lot of big ticket items, a lot of big aircraft programs. Those are sort of the most lucrative weapons that we sell overseas. A lot of missiles. The primary focus, especially in the Middle East, is air and missile defense. Due to the nature of the threat there in Iran.
So is that why Saudi Arabia needs all those jets?
The government won't say so, but yes, in a word, yes. The Saudi Arabia wants to sort of project a strong front. I mean, there's also domestic issues like terrorists coming from Yemen in the sort of southern border. And having
you need fighter jets for that?
It's a good question, and one you can ask Assistant Secretary of State Andrew Shapiro, because he cited that as a reason for the sale of the fighter jets and attack helicopters.
Well, we're seeing fighter jets being used in Libya right now, and the British are being criticized for that.
Yeah. Libya is fortunately for us, not on our list of customers right now, and hasn't been for a while.
But speaking in Kuwait the other day, British Prime Minister David Cameron said, the idea that we should expect small and democratic countries like Kuwait to be able to manufacture all their means of defense seems to me completely at odds with reality.
It's true. I mean, the part of the reason the Middle East has so many of our biggest customers is that they don't have the capacity to build their own. But really, I mean, no one does. The U.S. and to a lesser extent, Russia and some countries in Europe is so dominant in building tanks, planes, missiles. You know, there are countries like Brazil and India that are trying, and China, to a more important point, trying to get in the game, but they are light years behind where we are.
Well, I mentioned what the British Prime Minister said, but he mentioned Kuwait. He didn't mention the fact that the planes that are being used in Libya were British planes. And many of these, the U.S. arms sales have been to the Middle East. Several of those governments, like Egypt and Tunisia, have recently been toppled. Are there concerns about what's going to happen to those U.S.-made weapons now?
You know, if there are concerns, we're not hearing them from the administration yet. The reality is that when we do sell weapons to these countries, in a way, we forfeit control over them. You know, they come with stipulations. We say you can't use them in untoward ways. And we do have end-use monitoring programs, so we have people on the ground, you know, watching the weapons that we sell overseas. But we're not going to get them back. I mean, that was the case in Iran in the 1970s most dramatically, and it'll be the case here, too.
And Afghanistan, there was a blowback where right. U.S. Stinger missiles were used against our own troops.
We spent millions of dollars trying to destroy them and track them down, yeah.
Well, one of the enduring images of the Egyptian uprising was the picture of tear gas canisters labeled Made in the USA. Isn't that bad PR for the United States?
It's certainly bad PR. I mean, Egypt's been a very interesting case. A lot of people have honed in on this $1.3 billion in annual military aid. We sort of had the optimal resolution with that, which is that it was demonstrated that you know, the military essentially did what we wanted in remaining neutral to an extent and side with us. And so it was clear that by giving them so many weapons over the years, we did exert some leverage over them. Admiral Mike Mullen recently told Congress that you can't cut back on military aid to Egypt. Just look at how useful a tool it's been. However, to your point, you know, it is a huge optics problem when U.S.-made F-16s are buzzing the crowds and tanks are in the streets, and it could be a very different situation in other countries if those weapons are used, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, the foreign aid. We sent a lot of money to Egypt. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. And they bought our arms. So are they using the money that our government gives them to buy weapons from U.S. companies?
That's exactly what's happening, yeah. So, it's going straight from us to them and back to the coffers of the companies.
So are we paying for our arms to go to other countries? Is that foreign aid, or is it a subsidy to our arms manufacturers?
I mean, those decisions are being made by the government. So in a way, yes, we are funding our companies.
My guest is Mina Kimes, who's a staff writer for Fortune magazine. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, appears in the February 28th issue of the magazine. Do we have any idea of who is the advocate for these weapon sales abroad mm-hmm. in the Obama cabinet?
That's a good question. A lot of people have pointed to Secretary of Defense Gates as an enthusiast for some of these deals and for exports and burden sharing in general. As I pointed out in my article, you know, there's one of the cables released by WikiLeaks shows Gates advocating on behalf of exports to Turkey. In that case, it was the Patriot air and missile defense system, which is made by Raytheon. And, you know, the cable indicated that he was in Turkey saying, you know, you should buy this program. So and he's also been a known supporter of reforming the rules that govern arms exports, which is something that's going on right now and will likely boost overseas sales.
So U.S. officials advocate for U.S. arms manufacturers abroad?
That's what the cables indicate, yeah.
One defense contractor told you that our embassies are working hand in glove with the U.S. defense industry to try to promote our military exports. Is that legal?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's something that's been going on for years. So, you know, whether there's actually been an increase in that or it's more of a continuation, I don't know. But the cables definitely indicate that, you know, our diplomats are in there talking to foreign defense ministers about buying U.S. weapons programs.
Why can't these companies, which have huge sales forces on their own, go down to Brasilia and sell their weapons? Why do they need the U.S. ambassador to do it for them?
Well, they certainly do, but there are very strict rules under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that govern the exposure that companies can have to foreign governments. And they also can't they can only sort of show their leg when they're trying to advocate on behalf of their own weapon systems because you can't reveal too much of what you have. You can't show the blueprints. You can't give them too much. The government, on the other hand, can do what they need to do.
Because the U.S. government has to pass on what weapons can go to what country.
Exactly. All military items that are sold overseas are first approved by the government.
But it's even members of Congress out there pitching weapon systems. Senator John Kerry, for example.
Well, he was asked to do so by one of the cables, yeah. And Congress, you know, as I mentioned, is when these major defense packages are proposed, they must go through Congress. But it's more of an opt-out, so they don't actually have to say, yes, we want to send it. They just can't not say no.
Now, you mentioned companies like Raytheon. Are they the major recipients of this? Raytheon, Boeing, who else?
Raytheon, Boeing, Lockheed Martin were the companies that I focused on. Lockheed, I believe, has the greatest volume of overseas sales. Raytheon has the greatest percentage of its sales coming from overseas.
Many people see all of this as part of a jobs program in this country. Are these U.S. arms companies globalizing like so many other U.S. companies have done over the past three decades?
Globalizing in the sense of trying to get more revenues overseas?
No, I mean manufacturing.
Oh, absolutely,
abroad.
Yes.
So in the end, it's less of a jobs program than we might imagine? It's just an American corporation program.
That's I think, a very good point. You know, whenever these deals are proposed, they come with two numbers. One is, for example, the Saudi deal, $60 billion. The other is 70,000 jobs or 80,000 jobs. And these numbers are impossible to confirm or track down because these companies use hundreds of subcontractors and in states all over the country. So you really don't know. You know, for example, the Saudi deal said 70,000 jobs, I believe. That's more than twice the size of Boeing's defense workforce. So, you know, where are these jobs coming from? It's very difficult to know. And those numbers are immediately, you know, repeated by the White House when they advocate or when they talk about these deals and try to talk them up. As far as jobs moving overseas, yeah, we've definitely seen more defense jobs move to other countries. The workforce in the U.S. has shrunk by about 39% over the last two decades, despite the fact that U.S. defense spending has increased a great deal.
Interestingly, the head of the President's Economic Export Committee is the CEO of Boeing.
Right, yeah, Jim McNerney.
I don't know whether I should read anything into that.
I think what you can read into that, he's in there advocating on behalf of U.S. defense exports. And, you know, I alluded to earlier this export control reform, which is an initiative spearheaded by the president to sort of change the rules that govern arms exports. The administration argues that they would sort of decrease complexity and streamline the lists and make it build higher walls around fewer items. Opponents of this say that they're simply loosening the rules and making it easier to export.
Well, what about something like the F-35 fighter jet, which has been a center of controversy? We shut down the engine program, although many people feel the whole plane should be shut down. There was concern that manufacturing in House Speaker John Boehner's district would suffer. But would that plane be offered to other countries?
Oh, it's already been offered to other countries. The F-35 is actually a really interesting case. It's kind of a next generation model of how we're going to build these huge weapons programs because it's being built in coalition with several other countries. And that was the plan from the beginning. And then now we're in the process of trying to sell them to our partners. We recently sold 20 to Israel with the promise of or the possibility of selling more. There's been rumors that we might even sell it to India, which is a country that until 2001 we weren't even selling weapons to.
India used to buy most of its arms from the Soviet Union.
That's correct.
They switched away from Russia for any reason? Is it because we offer them better arms or better deals?
A lot of reasons. One is, yes, U.S. weapons are sort of widely seen as more advanced, plus we give better service over the years. The other is simply allegiance building. When you buy U.S., you're not just buying weapons, you're buying a partner.
But we're also selling top-of-the-line weapons, aren't we? In the past, weren't we trying to sell the stuff that we didn't want to use anymore?
I think that you are seeing more modern weapon systems going abroad in the Middle East right now, ironically, while there's all this turmoil, on Sunday, they opened the International Defense Expo that they have there. It's a biannual sort of trade fair where all of the defense contractors come from all over the world and billions of dollars of deals are announced. And it's sort of huge kind of free-for-all. And they Lockheed Martin just announced that they're planning on selling up to $7 billion worth a deal called THAAD to the UAE, which is the top-of-the-line missile defense system.
The missile defense system mm-hmm. that got the Soviet Union so upset and still has Russia upset.
That's sort of the plan to arm the entire region, yes.
And we'd be offering Patriot missiles to these people?
Oh, we already have, yeah.
Well, there are patriots in a lot of different countries. I shouldn't be surprised. Mina Kimes is a staff writer for Fortune magazine. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, is in the February 28th issue. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Mina Kimes, a staff writer for Fortune. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, appears in the February 28th issue of the magazine. We've been selling arms for a long, long time, haven't we? Even after Dwight D. Eisenhower warned us about a military-industrial complex?
Yeah, that's correct. The U.S. has been the world's biggest arms dealer for a while.
And it didn't matter whether it was a Democrat or a Republican in the White House?
It's really mattered more just whether other countries had the capacity and desire to buy them.
Well, we do give preferential treatment to some countries, don't we? We make certain weapons systems available to Israel that we might not make available to would we have made the same ones available to Egypt?
Israel is an interesting case because in addition to receiving the greatest amount of U.S. foreign military aid, about $3 billion a year, they also are legally – there's a law in the U.S. that dictates that they have this thing called the qualitative military edge, which means that they are legally bound to have better gear than anyone else in the region.
Now, Israel does also – manufacture its own arms.
They do,
in fact,
yes.
Some very sophisticated systems.
Yes.
So, do they sell to the United States?
You know, I don't think in great quantities. I do know that they are a large producer of drones. Mm-hmm. So, if there was anything, I would think that. And I'm sure, you know, they definitely do sell small sort of parts, and they're definitely a subcontractors on some of the major programs.
Didn't you attend an unveiling ceremony in the state of Georgia for the sale of 6 C-130J Super Hercules jets to India?
That's right. Yeah, it was the first major foreign military sale to India.
Now, the Hercules jets, what are they, transport jets?
Or? Yeah, they're tactical airlifters, so they can carry just about anything, paratroopers, gear, food, humanitarian aid as well.
The ceremony sounds slightly ridiculous. Can you describe what it was like?
Yeah, it's called a rollout, and apparently they have them for all of these big sales, and there's much ado in local media, and often sometimes you'll get your local senators to come, and they are signifying the rollout of the first plane or whatever it is that's going to be delivered to the other country, so often dignitaries from the other country are also there.
But they also have rock and roll fog machines.
It was raining and they were afraid that they wouldn't be able to do the big reveal because the rain would be getting in the way. But at the last second, you know, the skies parted and they sort of did this huge door coming up and the rock music and everyone went outside and...
Well, but in the case of selling transport planes to India, would that be seen as helping their military?
Definitely, yeah.
It's not the same thing as selling a fighter jet or some missile system.
Well, I mean, transport planes are used in combat, so it's a military item.
Is there a reason that we seem to be willing to sell to almost everyone in the Middle East? Is that because they have the money, or because we see this as a tactical thing, something that involves defending against Iran?
Well, I'd like to say there are three sort of main interests that go into arms sales, two of which the government talks about. Those are foreign policy interests, so ally building. Often there's sort of a diplomatic quid pro quo that goes into these deals. So In arming these countries, we are indicating U.S. support and building coalition against some of our, you know, not allies. And then the second is national security. So those are the interests of the U.S. military, which is spreading the burden. And that's a very real benefit to arms sales. You know, the idea is that if we give these countries in the Middle East weapons and the capacity to defend themselves, that means we have to send fewer U.S. troops to those areas. Then the third, which is one that you won't hear from, you know, the State Department, is the economic reasons, and that's what you're talking about here, which is that these countries are amongst the few countries in the world that have the ability to spend billions of dollars on U.S. weapons.
Especially the ones that have petrodollars. So we're getting dollars back from Saudi Arabia.
And I think that the strength in oil prices right now, though that is a little bit up in the air at the moment with what's going on in Libya. But the oil prices have been strong this year, and that, to me, indicates that, yeah, we're going to see a continuation of offers from Saudi Arabia and the like.
Well, you mentioned the arms sales to the Shah of Iran before the Iranian Revolution. That was a long time ago. Are those weapons still functional?
Good question. Iran likes to make you think that, or Iran works to project that they have functioning weapons. And, you know, we sold them dozens of F-14 Tomcats. Are they still functional? Unclear.
I guess Cuba, Cuba still keeps a lot of old U.S. cars going, I guess.
Yeah.
If we were to go to war with Iran, they might very well use some U.S. weapons against us.
Well, we'd recently arrested a man in Long Island, or not Long Island, rather, Long Beach, California, for trying to sell ejector seats and cockpit manuals or something like that to Iran. So we still very aggressively prosecute people who are helping the Iranians maintain these weapons that we sold decades ago.
My guest is Mina Kimes of Fortune magazine. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, is in the February 28th issue of the magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The recently proposed 2012 Obama defense budget has lots of new spending in it, including $24.6 billion for 11 new ships, billions for new missiles and nuclear weapons upgrades. It's not like we have stopped buying our own weapons. So how important are these foreign arms sales?
They're more important than they've been in a long time. And that's because, well, to the companies, because these are publicly traded companies and they must show, you know, growth to please their shareholders and support their stock prices.
So how important to their bottom lines are the foreign trade?
Increasingly important. I mean, most of these companies currently derive between 10 and 20% of their sales from overseas. As the U.S. defense procurement budget flattens or goes to slower growth, you know, it's not going down.
And is it unlikely to go down?
We
don't have a Soviet Union and a Cold War to consider
anymore. Well, we have China in the eyes of these companies. But what we're looking at right now, I don't know if it's going to go down in the future. What we're looking at right now, based on what Secretary of Defense Gates has proposed, is slowed growth and then flatness, right? And when you're looking for things to cut, you know, it's a lot easier to cut procurement than it is to cut some of the other areas of the budget. So it's not going down, but it's not going up, and that's a problem for these companies. Meanwhile, foreign sales are going up. I think, you know, Raytheon recently, last quarter, showed a 1% increase in domestic sales and an 11% increase in foreign sales. That's double-digit growth, and that matters a lot to these companies.
Well, you write in your article that, quote, in just the last 2 years, Obama has announced a series of sweeping changes that could revolutionize the way we export weapons. So
right.
are we selling them with strings attached now?
Let's export control reform, and that is sort of an idea or a movement to change the lists that govern arms exports. So there are two lists. There's the U.S. military list, which is military items, and then there's dual-use items, which are less regulated and can be exported to China. The export control reform movement aims to move a lot of the items on the military list down to the dual-use list or off both lists altogether.
Well, one of the concerns with selling certain arms to China is that they then start doing their own knockoffs. Isn't that true?
Absolutely.
Isn't that more of a concern than whether we go to war with China, which seems to be rather unlikely?
That's a huge concern, and I think it's one that the government is certainly taking into account during all this. I mean, China for years bought weapons, you know, very advanced weapons from Russia, and at the last arms show they had unveiled some pretty dramatic knockoffs and have not been buying from them. And who's to say that wouldn't happen to us, although we haven't been selling them weapons since the 80s.
Well, what about the argument that we might as well sell some of the weapons that we have available because if we don't, somebody else like China eventually will?
That's certainly an argument that comes into play when we're asking why sell to some of these Islamic dictatorships or countries that are, you know, less than allies. Well, someone else will. Russia will. China certainly will. They've shown a willingness to sell to anyone.
Can you take us through the current weapons sales process? How does it work? Is there any regulation?
There's a tremendous amount of regulation. So if a country wants to buy a big program from a U.S. contractor, sometimes they'll buy it directly from the company, and those are called direct commercial sales, and they must be approved by the State Department, which is a pretty rigorous process. Or in about half the time, it goes through the Department of Defense, which executes the sale. And those are often the big sales that are notified to Congress that you hear about.
Well, you say there's a rigorous process. Didn't the White House waive the Child Soldier Act so that we could sell weapons to Sudan and Chad recently?
They'll still go through the process, though. I mean, all weapons sales are examined, hypothetically examined for human rights concerns, how they'll affect the regional dynamic. Although, as I mentioned in my story, a recent department from the Government Accountability Office points out that in many cases, the State Department has done a less than stellar job of documenting that process and those sales.
Have there been any rigid audits? I know the Pentagon is never really audited,
yeah,
even though it's supposed to be.
You know, one of the stunning things to me when I'm reporting this piece was how difficult it was to find clear numbers. The Department of Defense, you know, I spoke about how there's two ways. You can go through the DOS or the DOD. And the Department of Defense does pretty clear, updated figures. But if you want to figure out how much has gone through the Department of State, well, that hasn't been updated on their website since 2008. It's next to impossible to know how many arms the U.S. is selling abroad.
How big a trade do we have with Pakistan, which is a country that not only can be seen as unstable,
sure,
but also has a rather bad record of its own, selling its nuclear secrets to anybody who's willing to pay?
We sell quite a bit to Pakistan, billions of dollars, I believe, arms.
And no concern that those weapons could wind up anywhere, or at least one of those weapons can wind up anywhere where somebody wants, mm-hmm, to try to manufacture it himself?
Well, there are strict end-use monitoring programs to forestall diversion or theft, stockpile theft. That's the best that we can do. Although I will say that from talking to experts in the field, the U.S. does do the best job in the world of monitoring its weapons after this.
Although I could imagine a conflict breaking out between India and Pakistan, in which all of the weaponry is manufactured in the United States.
Or in the Middle East, yeah.
So where has the arms control community been in all of this? Have they been sounding alarms?
Yes, but another surprising thing for me was that it's shrunk quite a bit over the last decade. This is not – these huge conventional weapons sales – I say conventional weapons to talk about planes, tanks, the things used in conventional war versus nuclear threats. They have not garnered as much attention as they used to because they don't pose as immediate of a threat. They don't involve terrorism. They're not going to be – a terrorist isn't going to steal a bunch of F-16, well, God willing. And so in many ways that the – focus of, I would say, you know, some concern and attention in the media has shifted elsewhere.
And the U.S. and Russia have signed a major nuclear reduction treaty,
right,
which I think at least symbolically would have an effect on the arms control community. But we're talking about increases in arms all over the world, the United States sending arms everywhere.
But it's more of a long-term threat. You know, it's the risks of diversion or theft or regime change, well, until recently, right, have all felt not near and present. And I think that has been one reason why it hasn't attracted as much interest.
Has anybody proposed a conventional weapons treaty of the sort that we see with nuclear weapons?
The United Nations has a treaty in the works. Yes, that actually Obama has gotten behind.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Mina Kimes is a staff writer for Fortune magazine. Her article, America's Hottest Export Weapons, is in the February 28th issue, the issue with a big front cover story called The Bomb Biz. And I wanted to thank you for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.